This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 30th of November 2010, our guest was Professor Malcolm Sawyer of the University of Leeds, who spoke about the current policy of fiscal consolidation. You can download slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Well, I feel to some extent talking about Keynesian policies and so forth to this audience. I might struggle to find something new to say to you, or you haven't. I'm sure you know all the arguments about why fiscal consolidation won't work and all sorts of things like that, but I'll try to find something a bit new to say. Okay. I think, in a sense, one of my starting points is that after the financial crisis, clearly there was a uptake, as it were, of Keynesian policies. Budget deficits were allowed to rise. There was some discretionary stimulus. But I think since probably maybe the beginning of this year, there's been a big turn in the direction of reducing budget deficits. But also aiming to not only have fiscal consolidation, but also to effectively reduce budget deficits to zero, or rather more accurately, to reduce structural budget deficits to zero. And partly what I want to argue is that that is likely to be rather counterproductive, but I also want to kind of argue that this runs against pretty much all historic experience. That is, structural balance budgets have not been achieved, I don't know whether ever, but certainly for many years. And so one has to think in terms of what are the implications of now seeking to have structurally balanced budgets, in terms of does that mean there's been some changes in investment and savings behaviour which would be consistent with those such budget deficits. And I essentially want to argue that that hasn't been the case. So I really want to go through it in the following sort of order. I'm going to start by sometimes reminding you of two basic relationships, and that's really will be a reminder, and apologies for that in a sense. I then want to go on to, in a way, ask the question for the UK specifically, but also this would apply, I think, across the board, which is if budget deficits rose in the face of recession, and most people recognise that was the case, why don't we just sit back and wait for the recovery to come and then the situation will reverse itself? Why has there been this change in terms of now aiming to cut expenditure, to consolidate the budget, and to aim for a balanced structural budget? So really, why can't we just let the situation unwind? That's the first I want to. And in terms of trying to answer that question, I want to make two arguments. One is to note that there's been what I call here two lots of moving the goalposts. One in terms of changing the objectives of fiscal policy, and the second is changing what has been deemed to be potential output. In terms of the objectives, the argument is that prior to the financial crisis in this country, the objective of fiscal policy was said to be to obey the golden rule and to obey the code for fiscal stability, which meant in practice a balanced on average current budget position, but borrowing for public investment, and that was consistent with a average budget deficit of the order of 2-3% of GDP. Whereas now the objective is a structural balanced budget overall, and hence that represents a tightening of fiscal policy from a deficit of 2-3% on average to a zero on average. The second one is what has happened to the estimates of potential output. Because if you think in terms of a structural budget deficit, that is the budget deficit which would arise when there's a zero output gap, when output is equal to potential output. Now, if you change what one thinks is potential output, then the overall level of output in the economy will be changed, and that has implications for the budget deficit. I'll talk a little bit about that shortly. Then I want to move on to argue that balanced budgets are undesirable, that we should not, there should not be any aim for balanced budgets, and then to argue that structural balanced budgets may well be unachievable. Whatever governments do in terms of cutting expenditure, raising taxes, at least in terms of structural balanced budgets, which after all has to be a balanced budget at a zero output gap or where output is equal to potential output, may well be unachievable. I then want to some extent, not exactly switch direction, but refer to what is here enigmatically put down as three ways to full employment. This is a reference to a paper by Mikhail Kolevsky in 1944, where he argued that, in effect, capitalist economies face deficiency of aggregate demand. If one is going to achieve full employment or some desirable level of economic activity, he suggested there were three ways to stimulate demand to be consistent with full employment. One was running a budget deficit. The second one was stimulating investment. And the third was reducing inequality in a way which would then stimulate demand. Now, to some extent, I want to add two other ways to that, although one of them I should then dismiss. Another one would be stimulating net exports, and the fifth one could either be thought of as appealing to the balanced budget multiplier type of effect, or, in effect, taxing savings in order to reduce the propensity to save. And I want to look at those, in a sense, five ways or five policy dimensions. And what I want to argue is that investment, stimulating investment, has limited effectiveness, or not limited effectiveness, a limited role to play. Stimulating net exports cannot be a universal panacea for obvious reasons. And then one focuses upon the reducing inequality and reducing the propensity to save as the other alternatives. Now, the two basic relationships are well-known one relating government deficit to the net balance between savings and investment, and then the current account deficit. And I want to treat that as the sort of post-Keynesian element is that views the budget deficit in effect as a residual in two senses. One is that government set expenditure and tax rates, but the resulting budget deficit is a residual in the sense that it depends upon what the private sector do in response to that. The second sense is in terms of the way that the budget deficit should be targeted or aimed for, which is to in order to secure a high level of economic activity so that the budget deficit should be consistent with whatever would happen to savings, investment, imports and exports at a high level of economic activity. The second one is the relationship between the deficit and the debt ratio, that it can be fairly easily shown that if a budget deficit of relative to GDP was maintained, then the debt to GDP ratio would stabilise at B equal to D over G. The debt ratio would equal to the budget deficit divided by the nominal growth rate. That is when we look at the total budget deficit. And then if we look at it, the next line down there, the relationship between the primary budget deficit to GDP and the interest rate on bonds. There are two features about that I want to kind of point to, although and this would be kind of implicit in what I'm going to say later on, but rather than explicit. The first one is that if we could take it that the rate of growth of the economy, G, is close to the real rate of interest on bonds, and particularly if G equals I, then you can relatively easily show that, in effect, what will happen then would be that the overall budget deficit would equal the interest payments on the debt, and consequently, what would be happening is that the borrowing from rentiers will be paying the interest to rentiers. So it would be rentiers to rentiers. Now that kind of, I think, is significant in the sense that quite often there's the argument, well, this borrowing is a burden on the future generations. And I saw recently, Nick Clegg was on television, and he was almost crying, I thought, at one point, when he was saying that the terrible aspect of the budget deficit being this terrible burden we were leaving to our future. Now, I think we all know why that is wrong, that argument. But in effect here, if we particularly look at where the G is close to I, then it is rentiers to rentiers. So rentiers are paying rentiers. So the second point to note is that G might be quite close to I. The growth rate might be quite close to I. And I have it on great authority. The great authority is the Brown Report on higher education financing. And if you look in that, it argues, you may recall, it argues that students should be paying a real rate of interest of 2.2% on the fees borrowing. Where does the 2.2% come from? It's their calculation of the average cost of borrowing to the government. It's the average. It doesn't give a full source, so I don't know over what period of time, but 2.2% is their idea of what is the cost of borrowing so far as the state is concerned. So clearly the argument for fees is, well, the state has to borrow at 2.2%, so it should charge the students 2.2%. Now you might notice that 2.2% is lower than the rate of growth of the UK, or at least it might be lower. Might be not right now, but if we take the growth of potential output, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility, is like 2.35%. In the past, it's been much more like 2.5 to 2.75%. So the growth rate does seem, on that sort of basis, and I think there's other evidence as well, is either close to or perhaps even above the rate of interest. The growth rate is above the rate of interest on borrowing. Now, that would mean that, in a sense, not only is a budget deficit sustainable, because if you look at the top line, the overall budget deficit clearly is sustainable, but also that a primary budget deficit would be sustainable. It would lead to if it was maintained, it would lead to a relatively high debt-to-income ratio, but it would actually be sustainable. So I think on these sort of arguments, I mean, I'll go into much more detail, but I think the idea that in some sense deficits are not sustainable is itself not sustainable. Just the relationship, at least for the UK economy, may well not apply for quite a number of economies which would be faced with higher rates of interest, but for the UK, it does look as though the growth rate is round about the rate of interest. Okay. So, let me look at my first point. The budget deficit rose because of recession. Why not let recovery come and reduce the budget deficit? I think there are two kind of minor arguments and then two more major arguments I want to point to. The first argument may well be, well, there was after all a financial crisis. We know that prior to the financial crisis, the financial sector was rather profitable and were kind of high tax yields. There's also the case that because of the housing market boom, the yield in terms of things like stamp duty was rather high. So if we go back to those sort of conditions, we won't go back to those sort of conditions, but if recovery comes, and we presume that financial profits are rather lower, there's rather less transactions in the property market, then the tax yield will be rather lower. So we might have to, as it were, adjust the tax for those that, those kind of sectoral shifts. The second part would be, well, there was some increase in discretionary expenditure during the financial crisis and afterwards, so they would have that as the recovery takes place. Not would it be just that there would be the automatic stabilisers would go into reverse, that tax yields would rise, but also there would be some reduction presumably in discretionary expenditure, which was introduced in order to address the crisis. So there's those two kind of caveats on one side. However, let me look at the main two. The first one is that, which in a way kind of repeats what I was just I said in the introduction, which is there's been a shift in the objective of fiscal policy, which as far has had extraordinarily little attention. It's sort of buried away in the budget. As far as I can see, is never challenged by the Labour Party, I suspect because they feel that the golden rule of public finances is associated with Gordon Brown, and that's associated with all sorts of issues, so they don't want to kind of bring that forward as a reminder. But what I want to argue is that the effect of that change is really quite significant. Now also, what I want to make the obvious argument, that the case is put as in terms of reducing public expenditure is that this is something which has to happen. It has to, you may recall at the end of the comprehensive spending review, Osborne said this has brought Britain back from the brink, you know, that if expenditure was not cut, then all sorts of dreadful things would follow, so that it was a matter of necessity. Now, I just want to here to make the very simple argument that is a matter of choice. It is in part coming through a change in objective. Now, if you look, for example, yesterday in terms of the report which came out from the Office of Budget Responsibility, there within their forecast, and you can also look back in terms of the budget, the argument is that the aim for 2015 is to return the budget position to a balanced structural budget over that time frame. Now, as I mentioned, I think the golden rule of public finances was consistent with a budget deficit of 2-3% of GDP. We can work that out, for example, if you take that within that golden rule, the debt-to-income ratio was intended to be around about 40%. We applied the formula which I had up before, a 40% debt ratio is consistent with about 2% deficit on average, if the nominal growth rate is 5%, which is not too far off. Or if you look at it from the point of view, what was the scale of public investment? Well, again, the orders of 2-3%. Or alternatively, you just look at what was the average budget deficit over most parts of this decade. Again, it was between 2-3%. Now, since quick back-of-the-envelope calculations indicates that if you move from a situation where at an average budget deficit of 2-3%, and I'm going to take the upper figure of 3%, and go to zero, then, and if you're going to do that all through public expenditure, well, you've got to be cutting at least, so even without allowing for any kind of multiplier type of effects, cut public expenditure by 3% of GDP. 3% of GDP translates into a reduction in public expenditure of the order of 6-7%. Now, if you go further and say, well, after all, if there's public expenditure made, a proportion of that comes back immediately to the state in the form of taxes, income tax and so forth, and make allowances for that, then you would get up to a figure much more like 10%. So quite, are we now getting up towards the order of scale of magnitude of the cuts which are, in a sense, being proposed? Now, we could go, really what I ought to do is to go through this in much kind of finer detail in terms of making the calculations. And the figures presumably would change somewhat, but I don't think the orders of magnitude are going to be that far different. But as much as anything, I want to make the argument that the reductions in public expenditure which are now being planned are coming about as a matter of choice in terms of changing the objective, not as a matter of necessity, and that's the kind of significant argument I want to put. Now, the second one is, in one sense, I find, in one sense, more interesting, but yet more kind of problematic, which is what has happened to potential output. Now, what has happened to potential output has, I think, important implications for what one perceives to be the cost of the financial crisis, on the one hand. It also has implications for, let me put it in a highfalutin way, interdependence between demand and supply, and past dependency and hysteresis effects. It also, of course, has implications for where the economy can operate at in the future, and whether indeed the economy has to operate round about the level of potential output. So I want to do this in kind of two stages. One is just to look at what has been said to have happened to potential output, and then really to ask the question, does the economy have to operate at potential output? So let me treat the idea of potential output, to start with, as unproblematic. And then I'll say why it's problematic. Going back to, I think it was March 2009, in the budget of that month, the Treasury introduced estimates of what had happened to potential output. And they, at that stage, put forward the argument that potential output, some kind of notion of supply potential in the economy, had shifted downwards by the order of 5%, and had done so, or would do so, over a period of about 18 months. So, if I remember rightly, something like from late 2007 to early 2009, there was a drop in potential output of the order of 5%. And they then went on to argue that when the economy recovered, it would start growing again, or potential output would start growing at round about the previous rate, 2.5% or thereabouts, but that the there would have been a shift downwards in potential output, so that although growth resumed, it would resume from a 5% lower level. Now, if we take that has come about as a result of the financial crisis, at least in the sense that reduction in potential output came about as a, at least it kind of coincided with the period of the financial crisis, then this is something of an aside here. It suggests that the financial crisis had the most significant large costs, because what this implies is that potential output is going to be 5% lower in perpetuity. And there was a calculation which Andrew Haldane, who was associated with the Bank of England, made, which if you then say, well, 5% lower output in perpetuity, let's discount that, and that's then equivalent to a year's GDP, as it were. So the cost of the financial crisis is about a year's GDP, so that's what, £1.4 trillion, something like that. So it has that kind of a very significant implication. The second implication is the one I kind of referred to, which is that if it really is the case, a fall in demand associated with the financial crisis can reduce potential output by 5% or a similar order of magnitude, it suggests that there's a close relationship between the level of demand in the economy and supply potential. Now, I think it turns out that this reduction of the order of 5% is not that different from the sort of estimates which Christopher Dow made in his book on five recessions in the UK economy, where he argued that if you look at the major recessions that have taken place, then there have been a fall in potential output of, I think he had it up as far as 10%. And then, so again, the cost of a recession is really quite dramatic. And again, I think his argument was that that fall in output was never recovered in the future. Now, one of the difficulties, I think, with this argument at the moment is, what is the link between the financial crisis, the recession, and the fall in potential output? And one of the things I find difficult to tease out of some of the budget statements and elsewhere is, what were the mechanisms involved? If we go back to the early 1980s, then the causes then of a reduction in potential output were very clear, because manufacturing industry had been more than literally decimated, you know, in terms that the large reduction in capacity, to some extent, so maybe associated with the rise in the price of oil, the rise in the exchange rate and so forth, but there was a clear reduction in capacity, so we knew, kind of could see why. It's rather less clear now why there's been this reduction in potential output, Now, what has, to some extent, changed is as these estimates of the change in potential output have evolved, is that the timing of the shift and the nature of the shift have changed somewhat. And in particular, the more recent estimates are that so the fall, the step fall in potential output was not as great as the 5%, but there may well be a fall in the growth rate of potential output. Now, some of this has come about. For example, it's assumed, I think, that the migration into the UK will be slower than it had previously been forecast. So that then leads to a fall in the growth of potential output. Now, if we look at kind of potential output, if it has fallen by the order of 5%, then by itself that would mean that tax receipts, or when the economy operated at a zero output gap, it would now be operating at a lower level of output than it would have done on past experience. So output will be lower, so tax receipts will be lower, maybe by the order of 2% of GDP. And if you want a balanced budget, it then follows that if you're aiming for that, then you're going to have some cuts in public expenditure to go alongside those that reduction in tax receipts. Now, there's also that kind of fall in potential output. Now, one way around of regarding it is, well, this is just a cost associated with the financial crisis. It's kind of a price we're going to have to pay forever because of the financial crisis. Now, I want to raise another kind of question related to that, which is, does the economy have to operate, or should the, probably not phrased very well there, should the target of where the economy operates be at potential output? Now, I think it's a kind of mainstream economist would say, well, obviously it has to. If you look at, for example, the new consensus in macroeconomics, where does the economy have to operate? Well, it has to operate where there's a zero output gap, where output equals potential output. Why? Well, if it doesn't, then particularly if output operates above potential output, then inflation will accelerate and we will get into all sorts of difficulties. So there's that sort of argument in terms, well, what is meant then by potential output is the level of output at which inflation will be constant. And I think it then contrasts with what might be a more almost obvious view about what is potential output, which is in some sense if not the maximum output that can be produced, at least that which could be sustained for a long period of time without, if we all worked at 70 hours a week, you know, we could increase output, but that you might think is not sustainable, although it is in the university system, since most of us do. But that would not be, I suppose, kind of regarded as sustainable. But if you think in terms of reasonable length of work hours, running the factory at a reasonable pace of output, then I think we would have a different notion of what we mean by potential outputs. Now, we also know, I think, from a Keynesian, post-Keynesian, Kletskin perspective, that typically the economy operates under what we might regard as productive capacity, and that the economy could operate at a higher level of output because there is the potential there to do so. So if one accepts that the kind of the best that one can do is to operate the economy around about these estimates of potential output, then indeed one would have to accept that there would have to be these cuts in public expenditure to balance the budget, if that's what we're aiming to do. However, I would argue that, firstly, the estimates of potential output, when they are used in the context of inflation, are at best misleading, because after all, they are then would have to be based on some notion of the Phillips curve, and that there's a level of output at which inflation will be constant. But what we observe for the last, 15 years is that if there's a Phillips curve, it is horizontal. You know, there's no relationship between inflation and output. So any estimates of the potential output which have been gained from Phillips curves type of analysis seem to me to be, spurious, as we say. So I would argue that we do not have to accept that the economy should be limited by potential output. That would also mean, of course, that we still have to create sufficient demand to get us to a high level of output. But the kind of two points I want to make, the two related points I want to make, is that this sort of moving of the goalposts in terms of changing the objectives of government policy and changing the estimates of potential output, but particularly the former, should be seen as choices, not so much perhaps the latter, choices which have been made, and that there's no necessity to observe that. Yet it is imposing quite significant cuts in terms of public expenditure. Oops, I'm the wrong way. Now I want to relate that with what I see as this trend towards zero structural budget deficits. There are, so it's three kind of clear examples of that. The one is the UK, where there is this zero structural budget deficit. Second is Germany, with the change in the German constitution. And I think interestingly there, again, as I understand it, Michael may well correct me, that previously under the German constitution there could be borrowing for public investment. Now, all is far after 2016, that would be largely ruled out. And the third would be if the requirements of the Stability and Growth Pact were actually imposed, that is the balanced budget over the cycle, and that's the total budget balanced over the cycle, and the indications seem to be at the moment that that is the direction which the European Union are moving in. Now, I then would make the point that this contrasts with historic experience. I mean, Germany, for example, I think has run budget deficits about equal to public investment. As I mentioned before, the UK, at least during the 2000s, did so. We could point that even if we look at the average budget deficit over the last 30, 40, 50 years, it's again that sort of order of magnitude. In the UK, I think it's 34 years out of the last 40, there's been a budget deficit. The experiences within the European Union are that there are budget deficits. After all, Italy and Belgium would not have debt ratios of 100% of GDP or thereabouts if they had not run budget deficits of about the order of, 5% or thereabouts for a long time. So, Now, the one of the reasons I want to contrast it with the historic experience really relates to the formula which is up there, which is that if a zero budget deficit is going to be achieved, there has to be some corresponding changes in savings, investment, imports and exports. Now, if also that zero deficit is going to be achieved at where output is equal to potential output, zero output gap, then in order for that to happen, savings have to be lower, investment has to be higher, imports have to be lower, exports have to be higher, or some combination of them. And is there any reason to think that behaviour has changed? I mean, is it the case that investment will now be significantly higher than it has been in the past? Will it really be the case that savings will be lower in the future? Or the propensity to save, I should say, will be lower in the future? Now, it clearly might be the case, but I've not seen any evidence to suggest that. Now, what I want to also argue is that, particularly when it comes to investment, for a number of reasons, it may be quite difficult to, or indeed undesirable, to stimulate investment much beyond its present sort of level, or rather I should say the pre-crisis levels. So if you take the case of the UK, gross investment ratio was, I think, between about 18 and 20% of GDP. Now, if you think in terms of what that involves in terms of looking at what is the sort of average capital output ratio, how that compares with the growth of the economy, if investment were to go up, let's say from 20% to 25% of GDP, then the consequence of that would be, I think, unlikely to be involved faster growth. I don't think that the British economy is going to grow much more than 2.5% a year. So the consequences would be, or likely to be, rising capital intensity. It would likely to be creation of capacity which is not then going to be fully utilised. It would likely involve a fall in the rate of profit. So not to mention that the environmental consequences of growing at a faster rate, even if it were achieved, would, for a variety of reasons, probably be unsustainable. So I think it is incumbent upon those who are arguing for a zero structural budget deficit to show that that is compatible with what they think will happen to savings, investment, imports and exports. If they cannot, then it would seem that effectively they would not achieve it. That is, if you try to have a balanced budget and that rests upon savings declining, investment increasing and so forth, and that doesn't come to fruition, then as a matter of that accounting identity, a balanced budget could not be achieved. So that's what I call the impossibility of the zero structural budget deficit. That is, after all, this is the budget deficit which would arise when output is at its potential. So if savings at that, or the savings which would be forthcoming, or people's desires to save at that investment and so forth, as there is greater than zero, then since the private deficit plus public deficit have to add to zero, if that's the condition, then you cannot get, as a matter of accounting identity, zero structural budget deficit. So that's what I then describe as the stupidity of the present UK and economic monetary union budget policies. Now, if we then just revert back to the case of the UK and look at the estimates, or the forecasts rather, which are being made by, well, said to be made by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Since they're a rather small office, I'm not quite sure how they make these forecasts, but and how independent they are is much, no doubt, for considerable discussion. But the forecasts, which then came out yesterday, I haven't gone through them, but I don't think they differ that much from the forecasts that were made back in June. How do they see the UK being forecast to achieve a zero deficit in 2015? Well, if you look at their forecasts, then it's based upon what, to my mind, is very rapid growth of investment, very rapid growth of exports, and of the economy in general. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, my calculations are divided one figure by another, but if you look at what they're looking about investment, then the investment to GDP ratio by 2015 would be higher than it has been for the last decade or more. If you look at exports, then the forecasts are that exports will grow almost twice as fast as imports, that the UK will reach a current account surplus for the first time since 1983, and that exports, as I say, will grow faster than imports. And I think, if I remember rightly, exports have to grow every year faster than the average over the last while. And argument, I find it's unlikely to occur. Now, it is possible that it will occur, and I suppose if you look at what the Office of Budget Responsibility said yesterday, I think it was that they think there's now a 70% chance that these estimates would be reached. So presumably there's still a 30% chance that they won't be. I think at a minimum, it says that there ought to be a Plan B. I presume that if these are not achieved, then they're not going to be missed by them, that investment will grow faster than forecast or exports will grow faster than forecast. I think the risk is all on the kind of downside. So if there's a 70-30, one would think that there ought to be Plan B, but it doesn't seem to be. But I think one can also link this with the experiences that have been had of these so-called expansionary fiscal consolidations, because I think it's now fairly clear that those episodes which are supposed to show that fiscal consolidation can be expansionary, and Ireland in the 1980s, Denmark I think also in the 1980s, Portugal, Canada in the 1990s, and one looks at that experience, it's to my mind fairly clear that much of it is luck. That is, it happened to be that at the time when these fiscal consolidation were taking place, there was a export boom, or there was other favourable events. And the one I looked at recently is the case of Canada, where we see that exports boomed, but this was in the 90s. There was the possible effects of the NAFTA agreement. There was the boom in the US, which obviously Canada exports to. There was also, interestingly, a collapse in the savings ratio by the household sector from things about 11% to near zero. But and the case of Ireland in the 1980s, again, the UK came to its rescue again there, in the sense that the UK economy was booming at the time, and that was providing exports outlets. So I think, kind of possible but rather unlikely that the UK will achieve the zero deficit. Now I want to kind of switch direction a bit. And I really want to do it in terms of raising the question, suppose that, for a variety of reasons, budget deficits are unwelcome. There's all sorts of political resistance and so on to them. What is the alternative? Well, in a sense, I think from a Keynesian-Kaletskian perspective, the alternative is to create the conditions under which a budget deficit is not required. Because why is a budget deficit required? Well, I think from a post-Keynesian-Kaletskian point of view, is because savings tend to exceed investment, or the propensity to save tends to exceed the propensity to invest. And if you want to then create the conditions under which a budget deficit is not kind of required, you have to create the conditions under which there will be more of a balance between savings and investment at a high level of economic activity, so that you don't any longer need, as it were, the budget deficit to absorb the difference between savings and investment, or to allow the difference between savings and investment to be realised by there being a budget deficit. So there are, in one sense, okay, one turns it almost like the other way around, because if we treat the budget deficit as more akin to a residual, is what is kind of needed in order to support demand, well, you then would need to find alternative ways of doing so. Now, having said that budget deficits run up against a great deal of political resistance, the others are also going to run up against a great deal of kind of political resistance. Now, okay, so Kolebsky, as I mentioned, back in 1944, put these, what he called the three ways to full employment: budget deficits, stimulation of investment, and the redistribution of income. And clearly the argument was that the stimulation of investment will add to demand, the redistribution of income, in the way that Kolebsky would want, that is, from rich to poor, from profits to wages, that form of redistribution would have a stimulating effect upon on the level of demand in the economy. Now, let me just link that with one other factor, which is that I think it's kind of well known that the distribution of income, whether we regard it in terms of the inequality of income between individuals or households, or the distribution of income between wages and profits, has, at least from my political prejudice point of view, got a great deal worse in the last 30 years. That in many industrialised countries, the distribution of income between households has considerably worsened. In some other cases, the distribution between wages and profits has changed dramatically, and I think probably Germany is the, or maybe almost the notable example of that, where depending on what time horizon, maybe the order of 10 percentage point change in the share of wages has gone down by. So there's been these large changes. Now also, a number of people have argued that that does have some links with the financial crisis. And this is a line which I think people like Stiglitz and others have argued, that the squeeze on lower incomes, for example, pushed people in the direction of having to take out consumer debt in order to maintain their kind of living standards. This build-up in consumer debt was eventually unsustainable. I would also put the argument that in looking at, for example, at this country, that one of perhaps the kind of unrecognised changes which seems to have taken place is that, at least for this country, corporations have become net savers. So the amount of savings which corporations are undertaking is greater than their investment. If they've got savings, more savings than they want, that they can want to invest, what do they do with it? Well, in one sense, that some way has got to be kind of recycled back to the households in order for the households to accumulate debt, having borrowed from the direct, probably indirectly as it were, from the corporations. So that, on the one side, the shift towards profits combined with a greater propensity to save, it appears, by corporations, then kind of feeds into this cycle of debt. So I think one could argue that the shift in the distribution of income has been a kind of at least a contributory factor to the build up of debt and the feeding into the financial crisis. So, if we then look at, as I mentioned, there are besides the three ways that Kolebsky mentioned, I think one could add net exports and one could add changing the propensity to save itself, not because Kletsky, I think, saw the redistribution of income as effectively changing the average propensity to consume and average propensity to save, but this may be by more kind of direct action in terms of savings. Now, if we look at those kind of five possibilities, and I'm not going to pretend that they are immediately on the political horizon, I would to some extent go along with Kletsky when he argued that there are limits to the stimulation of investment. That is, in the end, if and this has to be this argument has to be kind of modified, but essentially, if there is a something like a trend rate of growth in the economy, let's say of 2.5%, then we can calculate with the sort of likely capital output ratio what that implies about the level of investment. And if investment goes beyond that, then the consequences would be excess capacity and declining rate of profit. So that there is a limit to how far that can go. And I would argue that the sorts of levels of investment, as I mentioned, that have been experienced in many European countries are, if anything, greater than would be just required to maintain the rate of growth. So I was looking at some figures recently, and I have to inquire into these a bit more, but if we look at the investment to GDP ratio in a number of European countries, they're well up into the 20s, yet their growth rate is much more of the order of 2%, and that does seem to be a kind of mismatch. China can grow with 40% of investment to GDP, grow at 10%. European countries with 20 to 25% can only grow at 1 or 2%, which seems to be something of a mismatch there. So, but the general argument I would put is that I think there are limits to how far investment can be stimulated. Now, I think in retrospect, Kletsky underestimated the possibilities because after the Second World War, the investment to GDP ratio was much greater than it had been previously, but also, of course, the economy was able to grow much faster. So I think, as it turned out, if not through deliberate policies, at least the higher levels of investment were kind of consistent with investment being a stimulus to aggregate demand for many years. I put raising net exports down in a way just to complete the list, but I'm not going to say much more than that, other than make the obvious point that raising net exports cannot be a policy which all countries could successfully pursue. Okay, so if we then look at in terms of what this would involve in kind of policy terms, I think if we've looked at budget deficits in a sense, looked at investment, looked at net exports very briefly, but then one can concentrate on the other two, which is changing saving propensity through higher taxation and then redistribution. I gave a paper which I'm now drawing upon a few weeks ago, and someone in the audience raised this issue with me about saving propensity, which I'm glad to be able to incorporate here. But also I found that there has been an example of this policy being put into action, which was, I think, in Austria a few years ago, where there was a tax introduced on savings with the intention of reducing the tendency to save. So maybe it's not too far off, though.
Did it work?
Well, it worked in the sense that the saving propensity, I think, fell. But I think Austria still has a reasonable level of economic activity, but I haven't said it through. I think in the context of the UK, where, as I see it, whilst there is a low propensity, in some sense there has been a low propensity to save by households, there is now a high propensity to save by corporations. And unless that propensity can be brought down, it does limit the possibilities of achieving a high level of economic activity. Now, it doesn't need me to tell you the difficulties of trying to persuade people that savings are a bad thing. That's always been the great divide, hasn't it, between post-Keynesians and the rest, as it were, in terms of the old paradox of thrift and all that. But I think that could be I think it would be a very difficult case to argue, but it does seem to me a kind of logical possibility of seeking to reduce the propensity to save in order to stimulate demand. However, the last one I want to mention, and I think this is the one which in one sense offers the best perspective from a kind of economic point of view, but offers the least perspective from a political point of view, which is the significant redistribution of income. Now, having said that, one could, and I'll make a few more remarks on this in a moment, but we could sort of ask the question, suppose we could return to the glory days of 1980, and if we could return to the distribution of income which we had in 1980, whether it's kind of returning Germany to the wage share which they had in 1980, or in this country probably returning the distribution of income to what it looked like in 1980. What effect would that have upon demand? Well, if you take the case of Germany, let's just say right back at this extraordinarily crude back of the envelope calculations. What's the difference in the propensity to save and consume between wages and profits? Suppose that we could shift 10% of income from profits to wages, 10% of GDP. And suppose the difference in the propensities to consume and save are 0.3. Then that has a stimulating effect on the economy of 3%. And we're talking here about a budget deficit of 3%. And so we're looking at the same orders of magnitude in terms of the stimulation on demand. Now we could go through similar sort of calculations and say, well, suppose we could restore inequality of income in personal income to where it was in 1980, would that have a 2 or 3% change in distribution? So in one sense we wouldn't be talking about huge changes, it's just reversing maybe what's happened. So the argument though is that apart from all the other benefits which would come from reduced inequality, it would have these favourable effects upon aggregate demand, and it does offer a route whereby we could have high levels of economic activity without budget deficits, if that is the if that were the aim. I'd like to end by saying, this is not quite true, there is no alternative. That is, if you don't want if budget deficits are not required, is there any alternative to stimulating demand through other routes, and are there any other routes through other than changing the inequality of income? Now, clearly there are, because you could, for example, change savings, but there are those alternatives, and inequality reduction would be one of them. However, I think the general point I want to make is that the approach to reducing budget deficits works the wrong way around. That is, the attention is on reducing public expenditure, raising taxes, and so forth. It should be put the other way around and say, can we change the conditions which make a budget deficit necessary? If you can change the conditions, if we could change investment in savings or whatever else, then a result of that would be a reduction in the budget deficit. So we need to kind of look at it the other way around. Now, clearly it's difficult if the Chancellor stands up and says, well, we'll do this to expenditure, do that to taxation. For him to actually stand up and say, well, we'd like to do this to savings, it does sound sort of counterintuitive. But it does seem to me that, from a Keynesian, post-Keynesian, Kaletskian perspective, the budget deficit has to be viewed, as it were, through the prism of the other side of the equation. That it has to be looked at in terms of the private surplus, which would correspond to a public deficit. If you want to reduce the public deficit, then the way to do it is to address the private surplus. So I want to argue three things. One is that public expenditure cuts are a matter of choice, not necessity. Attempts to have a strictly balanced budget will not succeed, and reducing inequality is the progressive way to reduce budget deficits.